Hey, welcome to the Joe Scarborough Podcast. It's great to have you here as always. And in a little bit, I'm going to be talking to Derek Trucks. He's, of course, one of the great guitarists in rock music. You know, he's always on all the lists, whether it's Rolling Stone or Pitchfork, whatever list there is for greatest guitarists in music. Derek's always near the top of those lists. But before we talk to him, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about what's going on in Washington, D.C. Specifically, I want to talk to you about the fight to raise the debt ceiling. And I want to explain how it separates, what we're seeing this week, separates Republicans from Democrats and the way they look at the legislative process and the way they look at the battle between the two parties and the way they look at America. And here's a twist. I'm going to explain why I think Democrats need to learn from what they're seeing this week from Republicans, because they've got to fight harder. They've got to be meaner. They've got to remember what Bill Clinton said. I mean, that guy was a street fighter, a nihilist when he needed to be a nihilist. And he always said, when he was campaigning or when he was fighting Republicans in Congress, he'd say, it's better to be strong and wrong than right and weak. Because Americans, they don't care if you're right. If you're weak, they're not going to follow you. And that's what we're seeing this week. Mitch McConnell, when Republicans are president, will always say, we must raise the debt limit. We got to raise the ceiling because it would be irresponsible not to, because it would cause the economy to crash. So, of course, we're going to be responsible and we're going to raise the debt ceiling. What's he said this week? He said, oh, we've got to raise the debt ceiling. We've got to raise the limit, but I'm not going to vote for it. And not only am I not going to vote for it, I'm not going to let Republicans in my own caucus vote for it. And not only that, I'm going to make sure we vote against the rules so they won't reach the 60-vote threshold to be able to even vote on raising the debt limit on the floor. We're going to block all of that. And we're going to try to force the Democrats to push this through on reconciliation. Now, of course, this week, Mitch also said, we'll give you a couple months extension, but that's it. And then we're going to let America default on its debt. So Democrats, obviously, and the media, some of you would say it's the same, but Democrats and the media, Chuck Schumer, everybody's talking about how hypocritical Mitch McConnell is, how Republicans are nihilists, and how this is all so deplorable. And let me tell you what, it is. By the way, you can still use that word, deplorable. You still can, because when it's deplorable, it's deplorable. And this is deplorable. You got Mitch McConnell and the Republican Party perfectly content on wrecking the economy, trashing the stock market, really hurting Americans and shredding their retirement accounts, and giving a great advantage to communist China, because they'll be the biggest beneficiaries out of this. If we default, if the United States of America defaults on its debt, who is the biggest beneficiary of that? Our main competitor, our main rival, China, communist China. So yeah, this is a really nihilistic thing to do. But so the Democrats, the media, Schumer, they're all shocked and stunned and deeply saddened. How could he do this? How could he do it? I mean, it's a great question. I get the question. I understand the anger. But here's the deal. You shouldn't be surprised. I mean, not by this stage of your life. First of all, what you call this is politics. But this is a hyper-exaggerated version of American politics in the age of Trump. And we are still in the age of Trump as long as he dominates one political party the way he's dominating Republicans. But it happened. This has happened time and time again. You shouldn't be shocked. Are you still shocked that Republicans are doing this when they stood by Donald Trump after Charlottesville? Are you still shocked that Republicans are doing this after they stood by Donald Trump after Helsinki? when he said he trusted Vladimir Putin more than he trusted his own U.S. intel community, an intel community who by that time he had appointed all the leaders of. Are you surprised that Republicans are doing this when they kept standing by Donald Trump when he was attacking federal judges, when he was using Stalinistic attacks against the media, against the free American media, calling them enemies of the people? Are you shocked? After he lied about the pandemic as much as he did, they still stood by him. They still stood by him, even when he called for the arrest of his political opponent 2 weeks before last fall's election. Think about that. Think about that. Donald Trump was trying to pressure his attorney general to arrest Joe Biden, his political opponent, who was ahead of him in the polls. And he tried to do that, just like they would in China, just like they would in Russia, just like they would in Belarus. Tried to do that, and Republicans kept standing by him. What about January 6th? Lindsey Graham, this is the end. No, Lindsey went right back to supporting him, saying there is no future. There is no future of the Republican Party without Donald Trump. Kevin McCarthy, the same thing. Went after him for about 15 seconds on the House floor and then ran down to Mar-a-Lago to get a picture with him and to lick his boots. So at some point, you've got to stop being shocked. Can you be angry yet? Go ahead and be angry, be shocked, be stunned, be deeply saddened. I get it, all right? But after you get angry at the Republican Party one more time, maybe it's time to start getting a little angry at Democrats for not fighting back, for not knowing how to fight back. And this week is a perfect example, because when Mitch McConnell says he's going to trash the economy, Democrats shouldn't whine. They know that's what he's going to do. He's a nihilist. We get it. Republicans in the House, they're nihilists. We get it. Democrats should get it too. Stop being shocked. Stop catastrophizing. That's who he is. That's who the Republican Party is. They will torch the economy. But instead of whining about it, instead of whimpering about how mean Mitch is, they need to understand, Mitch don't care. Republicans don't care. Donald Trump, he just doesn't care. None of them do. Your shock, your outrage, you're catastrophizing, it just makes them smile deep inside. So what do you do? What do you do? You make them care. And how do you do that, you ask me? Well, as a former Republican, let me tell you how you do that. By fighting fire with fire. By matching their nihilism with your nihilism. And instead of going, I can't believe Mitch is doing, I can't believe he's doing this, I can't. No, you don't do that. If you're Chuck Schumer, actually what you do is you go up to Mitch, go, oh, Mitch, okay, I get it. Okay, hold on, let me write this down. You had said before, when Republicans were in the White House, that you were going to vote to raise the debt ceiling because it'd be irresponsible not to do that. Okay, I got that one. Hold on. I'm writing that down. Okay. And then now you're saying we need to do it again, but you're not going to vote for it. Right, Mitch? Right? Is that right? And not only that, you're not going to let your Republicans vote for it, and you're not going to even let us vote for it on the floor? Okay. Well, I get that, Mitch, but here's the deal. Here's the deal. When the economy starts burning, when you let the stock markets collapse, Mitch, when you destroy your own constituents' retirement accounts, when you give a massive advantage to communist China that they can't believe you're stupid enough to do, when you do that and you allow the Chinese to tell everybody across the world, our friends, our enemies, our allies, our adversaries, all of them alike, you'll allow China to say, look how dysfunctional the United States of America is. They're defaulting on their debt. When you do that, Mitch, this is Chuck Schumer talking, or what Chuck should say. Let me tell you what I'm going to do, Mitch. I'm going to sit back. I'm going to laugh. Because you know what I'm going to be doing while I'm laughing? I'm going to be calling a fucking vote every day. Every fucking day. And I'm going to call senators out every day. And as the markets are crashing, as your constituents' retirement accounts are going up in smoke, I'm going to call the vote. And guess what? There are going to be 50 Democrats that are going to be voting to raise the debt ceiling, to pay off our debt. Hey, Mitch, to pay off the debt that we accumulated under you and Donald Trump. This isn't for future debt, Mitch. And you know that. And your constituents will know that. Because they may not be paying attention now, but when their retirement account goes up in smoke, when the economy crashes, when you got China holding parades, and they're carrying posters of Chairman Mao and Deng Xiaoping and Mitch McConnell for destroying the U.S. economy, because you're going to be a hero. You're going to be right there with Mao. They're going to fucking love you in Beijing, in Shanghai. The communists that have just trampled rights in Hong Kong, they're all going to love you. Because this is the best thing you can do for them, Mitch. And when you're doing that, Chuck Schumer should say, I'm going to just be sitting back smiling. Because you're going to destroy your party. And the illiberals in your party that are trying to drive this country over the cliff for the sake of propping up a game show host. So that's fine. You go ahead and do that, buddy. And every day we'll have that vote. And every day it'll be 50 Democrats that are going to be supporting saving the economy, saving Americans' retirement accounts, saving us from giving the Chinese, the communist Chinese, this huge advantage. 50 votes, 50 Democratic votes to save America, zero Republican votes to save America. Zero. And what you're going to do is you're going to get on the floor and go, well, you know, there's this procedure that's called reconciliation. And if you, I know you don't talk this way, Mitch, but I can't imitate you, Chuck Schumer would say. There's this procedure called reconciliation. And you know what I'm going to say? 50 Democrats voted today to raise the fucking debt ceiling, to save America. Zero Republicans did. And not only would they not vote to save America, they wouldn't even let us take that vote. They blocked us. Okay, if they don't want to be responsible, they don't have to vote for this. We have enough votes to do this, but they won't even let us bring it to the floor. And then you know what I do the next day, Mitch? I put it on the floor again to vote. And you know what the tally would be? 50 to nothing. I'm good with that. I'm good with that. The economy would be crashed, but it'll all be on you. The markets will be destroyed. It'll all be on you. Retirement accounts just completely turned to shit. All again on you, Mitch. So I just want to let you know, that's what I'm going to do. See you around. And then when Mitch McConnell looked Chuck Schumer in the eye or any Democratic leader that delivered that message to him, and he really understood that he had just met someone who is as nihilistic as he was, guess what would happen? A wonderful, magical thing would happen. The clouds would part. And he wouldn't be talking about a three-month extension. He would say, hey, let's go ahead and just pass this. He would go back to his caucus, say, okay, guys, listen, we've backed ourselves into a corner. We got to get out of it. We got to pass the debt ceiling. We'll try to tie it with something else so it'll make it look like we won. But you know what? We got our asses kicked on that one, on this one. But that's okay. We'll have another fight in the future. But that's what Democrats need to do. That's what Democrats don't know how to do, because it seems to me that this is a party that continues to try to play by Marcus of Queensbury rules. That's not how you win in Washington. Like I said, Bill Clinton understood how to push us around, us Republicans, when we had confrontations with him. He just wouldn't blink. I remember when the government was shut down, Bill Clinton actually would veto every bill we sent to him. So we started to get desperate. We started actually sending bills that had the funding he requested. And you know what Bill Clinton did? He still vetoed the bill. We gave him exactly what he wanted, and he would still veto that appropriations bill. And they would say, why did you veto it? He'd say, well, it gave me the amount of money I wanted, but I just wanted to send a message. And he kept doing it until he broke us down and made Newt Gingrich go crawling over to the White House and settle on his terms. Why can't Democrats do that? Why can't they do that today? Bill Clinton could do it. You know, Mario Cuomo was a tough liberal in his time. Bobby Kennedy. Bobby was one of my heroes. I always liked what Jackie said about Bobby. Said, you know, he hates like his dad. He's a good politician. He knows how to win elections. He hates like his dad. Now, I'm not suggesting that I like people who hate. I think Jackie was making the point that he was focused on winning and would do whatever it took to win. And he didn't give a damn whether people liked him or not, or whether they thought he was playing by the rules or playing by Marcus of Queensberry rules. This is like FDR. Everybody acts like FDR had a 98% approval rating. Republicans hated him. He had about 38, 40% of the country who despised him, and FDR reveled in their hatred. It actually made him tougher. It made him sharper. It made him stronger. And if you don't read about it in the history books that much, well, that's because they want to paint a prettier picture of what went on. But you have to be tough. I mean, even when I ran back in 94 the first time, over in my little campaign office, I had a sign, one sign up, and it said, I quoted General MacArthur, there's no substitute for victory. When you're going into the campaign, that's how you've got to think. And you don't think, hey, I just want to win by one vote. Or hey, I just want to win. I want to get 51%. No. You fight like you have to get every dollar, like you have to get every vote, like you have to win every precinct. You want to win so badly that your opponent's dog is ashamed to be seen in public with whoever you're running against. I think that's a DNA thing. I think Republicans think that way. Democrats don't, but they need to. They really do, because you can't change the world if you don't win elections. And you can't turn your elections into mandates unless you know how to fight like the person you're going up against. And whatever they're willing to do, you need to be willing to do that, except you need to go a step further and just go into every fight knowing there is no substitute for victory. Failure, not an option. Whether you're talking about the debt ceiling, whether you're talking about voting rights, whether you're talking about whatever issue matters to you the most. And there's so many issues that matter today because we've got a party. Let's face it. We've got a party, the Republican Party in Washington, D.C., that's willing to destroy the economy. They're willing to hand this massive advantage over to the communist Chinese. And I just don't think it's in America's best interest for Democrats to allow them to do that. So get in there and fight like hell. The future of the country is depending on it. We'll be right back. Hey, everybody. Very excited to have Derek Trucks with us. Derek, thank you so much for being here. Great honor.
Thanks for having me, man.
So I want to talk first about you doing Layla and other assorted love songs. And it just seems like fate declared that you had to do this because, you know, of course, you're named after the band, Derek and the Dominoes. But I was just doing a little research. And is it true that your wife, Susan, was actually born on the release date of Layla?
It is. And, you know, we found that out the day we we're heading to rehearsal in New York City to rehearse that full record with the band. And I thought it was another cool nod to why we should be doing it. And, you know, there's a lot of family history with that record. Dwayne Allman, who was in the Allman Brothers with my uncle, they all met Clapton and Tom Dowd on the session at a show down in South Florida. And I think when I was 12 or 13, one of the first recording sessions I did was in Criteria Studio with Tom Dowd. And that was pretty surreal because a lot of magic happened down in that spot. So, it felt like it almost felt like we needed to face this record down and play it all and record it and then move on. So it ended up being an incredible night and turned into a record. So,
yeah. Well, it's incredible. I just have to ask you, though, you obviously grew up with the music. You said your dad would play it as you were going to bed. It was like in your DNA. That said, what was it like when you were, even growing up with it, when you're in front of the audience and you hit that first riff on Layla that we've all heard a billion times, and every time it's just as magical?
This show was one of those unique nights because we didn't announce what we were doing. So as you start playing the tunes from the album, the crowd starts figuring out what's happening. And so you feel this energy coming back and this anticipation. And that being the last song we played of the night, there was a lot of anticipation for that one. So pretty incredible. The audience there at that festival is pretty magical at times. And, you know, when there's 10, 20,000 people really tuned into the same thing, it's a good day. My dad was sitting side stage. He got a good seat for that one. So I knew when we walked off stage and he had this big goofy grin on his face that it was a good night, because he won't blow smoke. If it's not so good, he'll just, he won't say it wasn't good, but you can feel it. So he's a great judge. He keeps us honest.
You got the sign of approval. So while we're talking about drummers, let's talk about Tyler Greenwell, who I actually grew up with, played music with, along with Tyler and my dear friend Dave Simmons. That guy would sometimes show up in very nice restaurants playing. I'd turn around in the middle of a song, and Tyler wouldn't be wearing any clothes. Is he still a clothes optional drummer now?
Yeah, you got to keep somebody around with a robe just in case. he hasn't changed a bit, maybe a little bit. He was able to trick somebody into marrying him, and he has children. And
oh, my Lord.
He's pretending to be an adult, but he's incredible, man. He's one of those guys that musically and personally you would want in a foxhole with you, and we've been through a lot together. And he met a good friend of our, Colonel Bruce Hampton, who changed his life musically, and he changed mine. Colonel was the Southeastern musical guru. He would always say, "I'm a minor league baseball coach. I'm just getting people ready." And Tyler came through that school, and he somehow made it out. And I'm glad to know he hasn't changed all that much.
Well, I'm really glad to know that you've been keeping him out of jail and keeping him with a steady job. And now
mostly.
Guy's even married. mostly for the most part, Yeah, so talk about, you're talking about being in a foxhole. Mika's my wife and co-host of the show. We felt so blessed during COVID. We felt terrible for so many other people, but we worked together.
Yeah.
And so we got to be in the foxhole together during COVID. I have so many friends, so many musician friends whose worlds just blew apart. They were separated from their friends. They were separated from band members. How important was it for you to have your soulmate next to you, who also happened to be your musical soulmate?
We are so lucky. We built a studio behind our home in maybe 2006. So we've made all of our records here. And we were able to stay busy and keep working and keep playing. And the first few months, I don't think we touched an instrument, but then we got really antsy. And we ended up, between me and Susan and our group, maybe writing 30, 35 tunes. And as soon as we get people tested, we'd have them hole up down here in our studio. And, we ended up with like 3 or 4 records coming out of the lockdown. So pretty an amazing thing. Mike Madison, who is a great singer, songwriter in our band, and our Harvard English major, soul singer, which is a unique combination. He had this idea to dig into a source material. So he sent around the Layla Majnun poem, the original Persian poem. And his thing about the original Layla record was it's pretty one note thematically. It's this guy in love with a woman that he can't have. And Mike was like, what did Layla think about this psychopath? Like, what was her take on it? So everybody ended up writing tunes after reading this this 12th century poem. And there's a lot of amazing material that came out of it. But it was such a blessing being home with Susan and our kids. We got to spend more time than we ever have. We've been on the road 300 days a year, 200 days a year for 15, 20 years. So we enjoyed it. It was a tough time. In a lot of ways, and for everybody, we all lost people, and but we felt incredibly fortunate to keep doing what we do and not lose our minds.
I was going to say, Derek, for a band like yours, it seems like you get on the train, and it never stops because you've got to keep touring, because that's the essence of who you are, who your band was. This past year, year and a half, for all of the downside, I would think it was a great opportunity to stop and reassess where you were artistically, what you wanted to do, and you could rest up. I bet you're just raring to go now.
Yeah, when we finally got out and started playing shows, I didn't hear anyone whine or moan on the bus. I've never experienced that. There's a lot more of just... Everyone is so grateful to be back at it. A lot more gratitude across the board. And I think everybody realizes how fortunate we are to do what we do. And yeah, it's a different sense. I mean, there was, I think the world needed a soft, maybe hard reset in a lot of ways. And, you know, like a lot of these things, we think we learn something and then we fall back into old habits. But I do think some of it, a lot of us will carry a lot of those lessons with us forward and, but feel very lucky to be doing it.
Yeah, so lucky. A lot of gratitude, and that's something. Same with our family, and I know so many other people. So, Derek, before we let you go, I understand you're a big baseball fan.
Yes, sir.
Big Braves fan.
Growing up, we would drive up to Atlanta two or three times a year to watch Braves games. Bob Horner and Dale Murphy era. Those were my guys. So we're longtime fans and just baseball heads. I had a great uncle that pitched in the majors for 16 years, and we used to visit him when we were passing through Alabama. He was running partners with Satchel Paige and Mantle, and
oh my Lord.
He no-hit the Yankees in 1952. He was Virgil Fire Trucks was an incredible character, and that dude had stories for days. When they traveled back then, it was like the days when you were traveling with Tyler Greenwell. It was get in the van and go, and it was rowdy, from what I hear.
Yeah, I mean the fact that he was running buddies with Satchel Paige, one of the greatest pitchers of all time. Just unbelievable. So what exactly is planned for the next year? I mean, you're gonna be on the road for the most part. You're gonna get back into the studio or mostly just play live?
You know, a lot of it's out of all of our control at this point. So we have shows booked, we have things booked, but we're constantly watching and trying to figure out the smartest and best thing to do. But we're touring, man. We're out there. We're doing the Beacon Theater for a few weeks, which we're excited about. That's kind of a homecoming for the band every year. It's where you check in and figure out if you've gotten better or worse, or figure out what you need to tweak. But, you know, we plan on hitting the road, a lot of outdoor shows this next summer. We have a few records we're finishing up, but we'll stay busy. I found that on the break, it's a little downtime is nice, but I think we're all happier when we're grinding it out and working.
Yeah, so got to get out
that's
there.
That's what we'll be doing. Either duo, trio, quartet, hopefully the full band, but we realize we really like to play, so that's good.
Well, that's fantastic. Well, we can't wait to see you. I'm going to make sure I drop by the Beacon when you guys are there, and I will bring an extra robe for my good friend Tyler, or Falcon, or whatever they call him now.
I'll make sure he's clothed that night. I'll make sure.
Okay. Thank you so much. Thank you so much, Derek. It's great talking to you.
Thank you, man. We'll see you around.
It was great talking to Derek Trucks, and you can catch him tonight and tomorrow night
at the Beacon. What a show. The Tedeschi Trucks Band, they're going to be at the Beacon tonight, tomorrow night, and of course on the road for the rest of the year. Thanks so much for being with us on the Joe Scarborough Podcast. Talk to you soon.
Buying a car in Carvana was so easy. I was able to finance it through them.
Whoa, wait, you mean finance?
Yeah, finance. Got pre-qualified for a Carvana auto loan, entered my terms, and shopped from thousands of great car options all within my budget.
That's cool that financing through Carvana was so easy.
Financed. Done. And I get to pick up my car from their Carvana vending machine tomorrow.
Financed.
Right, that's what I said.
You can spend time trying to pronounce financing, or you can actually finance and buy your car today on
Carvana.
Financing subject to credit approval. Additional terms and conditions may apply.